white shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Moral, the string.
Tension by our whole dress.
Moral, the string.
Great gowns.
Moral,
beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to another episode of the Every Outfit Podcast. Chelsea, how are you?
I'm great.
Nothing of note happened this past week for you?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Did someone in your life acquire a new vehicle, perhaps?
Okay, guys. I guess the only way to put this is my wife had a quarter-life crisis and bought a Cybertruck.
I know there's going to be people in the comments. We're going to get DMs. The Cybertruck has gotten a bad rap, not just because...
Well, it's also not my Cybertruck. It's my partner's Cybertruck.
And you support your partner.
I do. She's a very Justin Bieber-esque person. This car makes sense for her. I love her for who she is. She's someone that would buy a Cybertruck. So who am I to take that away from her?
That's true. And it's not your fault or Tatiana's fault that the Cybertruck has a terrible reputation between driving issues and really the type of people that seem to own the car, Tatiana notwithstanding.
I will say it drives like a dream and I haven't seen a raccoon break into it yet.
There is, as we've discovered, a subreddit called Cyberstuck. But I have to say, I was very much a negative Nelly about Tat getting this car. I was like, it's going to break down on you. You're not going to be able to get insurance. It's not going to fit in your garage. And I've been wrong about all of those things. And I would just like to issue Tat an apology.
I'm sure that means a lot to her. Look, I will say, I was scared that it wouldn't fit into the garage either, but it does, just barely. I'm terrified to pull my car in and out of that garage.
Oh yeah, you don't want to be the one crashing into the Cybertruck.
Although I will say, Tat, getting a Cybertruck, it's good for me because that means that I get to inherit her old car, which means that I no longer have to drive a rat-infested Toyota.
R.I.P. We had some good times in there.
I don't know if we did.
To be fair, I think I've only ever been in that car once. I'm usually the one driving. Now, I must ask, are you going to trade in the car or do we open up a new Patreon level and for $50 a month, you can watch us burn the rat-infested Toyota?
Okay, $50 a month seems incredibly steep. I was thinking more like a one-time charge of 50 cents.
50 cents? I think you can get more for the trade-in than us charging 50 cents a pop to watch it burn.
Look, we'll see. I'm about to find out.
I will say I've had the pleasure of being driven in it once. It is so incredibly fast. It has so many dumb features, and I mean that in the best way possible. They are so dumb that they're brilliant. Like, you can set your turn signals to make fart noises.
Perfect for the kids.
And also, you can set the fart noises to be at any seat. Tat made it seem like I farted in the car.
Who even thinks of this shit?
Elon Musk. Chell.
Yeah, he also thought of romance mode, which I showed you, which basically like a crackling fire comes up on the screen and it plays Let's Get It On.
Right, except when Tat was showing it off, she still had the signal in fart mode, so there were just fart noises over that.
Not the most ideal combination.
You also showed me, although it was daytime, that the Cybertruck also does a light show.
Yeah, it does this really weird light show set to that song from Home Alone, where like Kevin McAllister is setting all the traps for the burglars.
The car is preposterous, but it does work for Tatiana's lifestyle.
Yeah, she has dozens of garment bags in the back of that truck right now.
And I was surprised that you guys were able to go to the desert on a single charge, which is usually a problem for electric cars.
Yeah, if you can't get to Palm Springs, what's the point?
Anyway, I love this for you guys. I can't wait for the adventures of the Cybertruck.
Thank you for your support. I appreciate it. Moving on. How are you?
I'm good. My week was very boring. I think we should get into some hot topics, or we would have called them hot topics, but so much bad stuff has happened this week. I think we got to play the bad news theme.
Bad news!
Only on Every Outfit.
So in sad news, Sarah Jessica Parker has announced that her shoe brand, SJP Collection, will be closing this fall. In a statement, the company said after 10 colorful years, SJP by Sarah Jessica Parker has made the difficult decision to close its doors this fall. The SJP Collection team expresses enormous gratitude to all of their loyal customers and supporters, as well as all those they've worked alongside.
This is sad because we do know people who work there. We've been to their offices in New York. And we did make a collaborative shoe with SJP Collection ages ago.
I think it goes to show that being an independent designer at any level is incredibly challenging.
Yeah.
And certainly Sarah Jessica Parker did the most to make this brand work. She has worked in the SJP Collection stores. She has worn the shoes in and just like that.
But the thing about SJP Collection is these shoes were not cheap. It's because they were made in Italy. They were actually well made. The shoes on the website now cost upwards of $500, which is a lot for a celebrity brand. It is closer to a Manolo than a Jessica Simpson or a Katy Perry shoe, which are mostly in the $50 to $100 zone.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly a luxury shoe price point where luxury shoes now, even Manolo Blahnik, go for $900, $1,000. But yes, it also wasn't that sweet price point that you associate with a celebrity brand. I think because she was trying to establish it outside of those tropes.
But certainly not affordable to most people who are Sex and the City fans. Although, to be fair, she sells fragrances, she makes wine, she publishes books that are more attainable.
Yeah, and I wonder if this decision did not come up suddenly because she was photographed wearing SJP Collection shoes as late as June on the set of And Just Like That, which I feel like is something that maybe she wouldn't have done if the brand was closing.
No, she's ride or die SJP Collection forever.
In Tough For Me news, which is the sad version of E! News, I guess, Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck are divorcing, which is something we all knew was coming. But Jennifer Lopez finally pulled the plug on Bennifer 3.0, or I guess Bennifer 2.0 in regards to Jennifer Lopez. She filed for divorce on their second wedding anniversary. Ouch.
Yeah, I've said this before, but I hope they both find the 12-step programs that they need. Although, who knows? This might not be the end of them. One day we could get Dear Ben Part 3.
That's true. I saw a tweet that was like, it's the Before trilogy, but it's Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez getting back together every 20 years to give it another go. So she cites the date of separation as April 26, 2024, which is about 2 months after the This Is Me Now album came out. So, Chell, where do we think things went wrong?
I feel like we've talked about this before. I think it's having a very different attitude towards fame. Although, who knows? You never know what happens in someone else's relationship.
Quite like the Justin Baldoni, Blake Lively behind-the-scenes drama, there's so many different source reports of what really happened that I can't decipher even a coherent narrative about why their marriage broke down. Like, it's hard for me to believe that they got divorced because of the This Is Me Now and the Greatest Love Story Never Told debacle. Because if you've watched the documentary with Chelsea, I know you have, he is very supportive of her and doing this endeavor. Now, there is a scene where she displays the love letters that he wrote for her. You just see his soul leaving his body when this very private thing is being shown to a bunch of songwriters to be like, help me write songs about this. If he genuinely was that upset about it, I think he would have had her cut it out of the documentary.
Well, it also could have to do with the fact that during the pandemic, a lot of people made a lot of big life changes that maybe don't make sense after the pandemic. Like the people that moved to upstate New York and are now like, fuck, I hate it here. What did I do?
Right. But for Ben Affleck, I assume that was his relationship with Ana de Armas.
Right.
And the film Deepwater, which seems like a fever dream.
I'm just saying, I think that the pandemic allowed them to reconnect in a way that maybe they wouldn't have had it not happened.
I do think it's kind of ironic because the whole narrative of The Greatest Love Story Never Told is Jennifer Lopez reckoning with the fact that she is, if not a sex addict, she is a love addict.
Yeah.
And if you remember, Chelsea, the climax of the film, quite like the penultimate scene of the series finale of Sex and the City, is Jennifer Lopez being like, oh, I need to be alone. I am enough. And then, like, if you remember, as soon as she has that realization in the rain, it dissolves to a desert landscape and she's marrying Ben Affleck. And even when I watched that, I was like, ooh, but you've actually never really been single before.
I don't know if the solution for J-Lo is being single. I think once you're that far gone, you just have to know who you are. She doesn't need to get married immediately, but she doesn't have to be single, certainly.
Oh, no, I'm opposite. I think she needs to go full Elizabeth Taylor. She needs to be married 8 times.
I'm sure she will. Speaking of doomed duos, the new Lady Gaga Bruno Mars duet Die With a Smile came out.
My first reaction is the song and the visuals don't exactly go together.
It sounds like a Bruno Mars song, like any song that he would release. The video clearly inspired by 60s variety shows.
I guess I was expecting, based on the styling of the still I saw at first, it was like going to be a country ballad. And it's even less Bruno Mars-y. It's like soft rock.
Well, a lot of people thought that this was going to be the first single off Lady Gaga's next album. Although, having watched this music video, this has to be for the Joker soundtrack. There's no other explanation for this.
Right.
And the Joker soundtrack is also rumored to feature Lady Gaga covering existing pop songs, which we get a taste of in the trailer.
The Joker sequel is a jukebox musical.
Yes, this music video looks like that film also, which has some sort of variety show sequence.
In the trailer, it's giving the Sonny and Cher show. But I will say the music video is stunning. Like, I love the Lawrence Welk kind of 1960s variety show look. I also love the detail that the audience are just mannequins that are dressed in country western wear.
Yeah, and Lady Gaga has a very good hairpiece, certainly.
But yeah, the song is not giving. It won't be on my Spotify playlist.
No, no one's going to listen to this song. Except for maybe Bruno Mars fans, because that's what they're into. No shade.
Speaking of Lady Gaga's co-star in The Joker, Hollywood was rocked by the news that Joaquin Phoenix dropped out of the latest Todd Haynes films just 5 days before production was supposed to begin, leaving the cast, crew, and investors high and dry. The reason cited by sources is that Phoenix got cold feet, presumably over the graphic nature of the material. The story revolved around a detective and his lover fleeing to Mexico in the 1930s, although, this is a tad curious since Joaquin Phoenix brought this story to Todd Haynes, and as Todd Haynes noted in an interview at Cannes last year, it was Phoenix who was pushing Haynes to make the sex scenes even more explicit, saying that the film would probably be NC-17.
We should also note that these are gay sex scenes. He has a gay lover in the film.
Yes, sorry.
It's so upsetting because Todd Haynes, Christine Vachon are heroes and I can't stand to see them disrespected like this. But also, now that I know this movie isn't happening, it's the only thing I want to watch.
Christine Vachon is Todd Haynes' go-to producer. She runs a company called Killer Films. And when this story first came out that he had walked away from the production, I was holding out hope that it wasn't because he got uncomfortable with the material. Because I knew that he had brought it to Todd Haynes. I was like, you know, Rooney Mara is pregnant again. Maybe it was like a family emergency. But then Christine Vachon, the weekend after this news broke, went on Facebook, which I love that Facebook is the go-to social media platform for boomer talent and independent film. Because that's Paul Schrader's favorite social media app as well.
Of course.
But she took to Facebook to confirm that a version of this story is true.
Yeah, that led me to look up her Facebook. And it's mostly just photos of her reviewing the wines in various airport lounges.
Oh my God. How have we not thought to do this?
I know.
So Variety and Hollywood Reporter have gone on to report that this is something that Joaquin Phoenix evidently does a lot. He tried to back out of The Joker last minute. He also did this on Mike Mills' Come On, Come On, and evidently only came back to Ridley Scott's Napoleon Project after they promised to bring P.T. Anderson in to do rewrites.
He sounds like a nightmare.
I did see a lot of online discourse because part of the story was the role is unrecastable. And a bunch of people online were like, no, you can just get another actor to do it. And I feel like those that are unfamiliar with independent film financing don't understand that, yes, of course they could recast the role with another actor. But in the world of independent film financing, every actor has a value, which is usually tied to their previous box office success. Because of the success of The Joker, Joaquin Phoenix's name is valuable. I've always found this concept fascinating because it's not like because someone sees an actor in a Marvel film, they'll then go see them in an independent film. Which I'm not saying Joaquin Phoenix was in a Marvel film. I know he was in a DC film, but I've always found
I'm not saying shit.
But for whatever reason, this means something. So there is not someone at Joaquin Phoenix's level that is available right now with 5 days notice to come and be in this film. Although I did see a tweet that was like, Tom Cruise, now's your time to prove how much you do love cinema.
A girl could dream.
I mean, Tom Cruise in a Todd Haynes film, I'd love to see it. Tom Cruise has finally finished the last of these Mission Impossible films, and I just hope that he goes back to being a character actor again.
Also, Todd Haynes should be enjoying the success of May December and building upon that.
It does seem like Todd Haynes is not struggling to find projects. Yeah, according to IndieWire, it says that Todd Haynes will just focus on a limited series called Trust that would reunite him with his Mildred Pierce star Kate Winslet, and this limited series is for HBO. So he's not hurting for projects.
Oh, that's great.
It just sort of sucks for the state of independent cinema because in a world where it's just very difficult to make anything original and so many things are based on IP, you really do need actors that are making these big IP films then make independent cinema to keep that thriving and alive.
I hate this. Also, this is not bad news, but can we briefly talk about this new Pedro Almodovar movie with Julianne Moore and Tilda Swinton?
The Room Next Door, the trailer debuted. I have no idea what's happening in this film, but I want it right now injected into my veins.
Well, it's his first English language film, although we wouldn't know that from the trailer as there is no dialogue. Also, it appears that they've made some sort of art house version of Beaches.
Is that what you think this movie is about?
Tilda Swinton clearly has an illness of some kind.
Correct, and she doesn't want to face the reality of her mortality, it seems.
But this is also clearly a glamorous woman having nervous breakdowns film because we have some weird relationship with Julianne Moore. They're in a very chic modernist house in what looks like the middle of nowhere.
Their personalities are slowly merging into each other. We don't know.
Yeah, the poster, like May December, does look like it's Persona inspired, certainly.
Or do these two women love each other?
I don't know. We see them sleeping in the same bed, although that could be some weird codependent caretaker sick person relationship.
But unlike the Todd Haynes film, we will know when this film comes out this fall.
Oh yeah, when does it actually come out?
December 20th, 2024. I can think of no better film for us to drag our parents to at Christmas.
Speaking of glamorous women, we have lost two Los Angeles legends, two absolute queens. Firstly, Peggy Moffitt. If you aren't super familiar with her, she was a 60s era model. She looked like an alien. She had an insane Vidal Sassoon haircut. She was a muse to the designer Rudy Gernreich. And together they created a look that is, I suppose, one of the most significant examples of avant-garde fashion in the United States, and certainly in Los Angeles. The fact that that happened here is something I will never understand.
I had always assumed that Peggy Moffitt was British.
Yeah, it was giving Europe. It didn't seem like this could come from the United States.
And let alone Los Angeles. But to learn that she grew up in Hancock Park, this is a woman that just had an eccentric, privileged, like accidentally legendary life that just doesn't happen anymore. The fact that her father was a screenwriter in Hollywood, she was going to the Brown Derby when it was the Brown Derby, when she decided to go to acting school at the neighborhood playhouse, she was taught by Sydney Pollack and then taught dance by Martha Graham. This shit doesn't happen to people anymore.
Yeah, she was really a woman of her time, certainly. And friend of the pod, Marissa Meltzer, did her New York Times obituary, which was fabulous. Also, while Peggy Moffitt was not literally non-binary, like, that's what the look was. It was about stripping away the gendered aspects of clothes and, you know, in Peggy's case, beauty. She really did look like nothing else that had come before her.
You want to talk about a signature style. That is a woman that maintained that haircut for 60 years.
Yeah, and still wore all of those clothes.
Well, maybe not the Gerdreich monokini, as it was called.
I hope she did. You texted me and were like, did you know that there's this children's book about Peggy Moffitt? Of course I know that, and I do have it, and I brought it today.
Oh my God.
It's very rare, and now it's very expensive since she's died, so I don't have a copy with the original dust jacket.
Pretty, pretty Peggy Moffitt.
It's really very cute. I don't even think she had anything to do with this children's book. I think someone else just made it about her, but I might be wrong.
Imagine being iconic enough that you get your own Madeline-esque children's book.
I know, it's so cute.
I thought it was interesting. I learned in her obituary that after Rudy Gernreich passed away, she retained the legal rights to his designs. I don't know if that was just the monokini that she made famous or all of his designs, right? There's this very iconic photo of her in this design shot by her husband. And she had this interesting quote where she said, that was the shot seen around the world. Think of something in your life that took 1/60th of a second to do. Now imagine having to spend the rest of your life talking about it. I think it's a beautiful photograph, but oh, am I tired of talking about it?
I'm sure. Well, okay, so the brand does still exist, but it's only swimwear. So you could buy that if you wanted to.
A tits out pool look?
I've been meaning to get one of their swimsuits because they're all reissues of stuff from the 60s. So they look very timeless and cool. But to my knowledge, they haven't reissued any of the actual clothes.
No one has taken over the brand to breathe new life into it like a Courage.
I'm now just realizing we mentioned Peggy kind of recently because she modeled Richard Simmons jewelry. Remember?
Oh, right.
Wow, it's all coming full circle. We also lost Jenna Rollins, star of The Notebook.
As a fan of Jenna Rollins, was it as startling to you as it was to me to see her work reduced down to The Notebook actress?
Well, it was also shocking for me because I completely forgot that she was in The Notebook. Like, I saw that movie when it came out. I didn't actually retain that much, although I might have to revisit.
Well, her son, Nick Cassavetes, directed that film, so that would explain why she's in it. And a few months back, he did reveal that she had been suffering from dementia, which is an especially bittersweet turn of events if you know the plot of The Notebook. You know, for me, I more associate Jenna Rollins' work with her collaboration with her husband, John Cassavetes, especially on films like Woman Under the Influence.
Yeah, she did invent the glamorous women having nervous breakdown genre, but she might have perfected it because she went further than most actresses were willing to go in terms of the types of films she was doing, edgier independent films, and also the fact that she was more willing to look kind of unglamorous on camera, let's just say.
Yes, I do love that in the New York Times obituary, they referred to her as Miss Rollins, who often played intoxicated, deranged, or otherwise on the verge characters.
Well, no one's ever been drunker than her character in Opening Night. Like, how she sustained that for an entire film is one of life's great mysteries.
If I were a betting person, I would have bet that she had won an Oscar. I was shocked to learn she hadn't.
Wait, I thought she won for Gloria. She absolutely won for Gloria.
She received an honorary Oscar.
Oh, really? Why did I think that?
If she should have won for anything, it would have been Woman Under the Influence. So I went back and I was like, who won that year? And it was Ellen Burstyn for the film Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which...
Okay, sure.
Sure, but it's also, if you think about it, in the last 40 years, do people talk about Ellen Burstyn in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore? Or
I talk about it. I just saw that movie on a plane for the first time recently, and I loved it.
I more meant the cultural impact, especially amongst actresses, in the last 20 years, 30 years, they reference Jenna Rollins in Woman Under the Influence way more than really any other performance, I would say.
I don't know. I think her and Ellen Burstyn are a similar caliber of actor. But wait, I feel like she should have won the Oscar for Gloria, but who beat her that year?
Sissy Spacek won that year for Coal Miner's Daughter, which is like, all right.
Definitely an equally good performance, but not a better movie, certainly.
I will say this is a stacked category. So Sissy Spacek won, Jenna Rollins was nominated, but who was also nominated was Ellen Burstyn in a film called Resurrection, Goldie Hawn in Private Benjamin, and Mary Tyler Moore for Ordinary People.
I'm thinking Mary might have gotten robbed that year.
I think so, too.
Although Goldie Hawn certainly deserves an Oscar. If anyone should win an Oscar for being in a comedy, it's her.
Absolutely.
Shall we get into a little bit of fashion news?
For reasons unknown, Rodarte has done a collaboration with the film Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. Well, not reasons unknown.
It's not reasons unknown. To me, that's the most intuitive pairing because it's two things that speak to alt girls and the Rodarte sisters famously obsessed with movies.
I should clarify, the reasons unknown part for me is that this collaboration is exclusively at Saks.com. That's the only place you can get this, or in stores.
Our favorite store, Saks.
In reading the Vogue article about this, I learned that Laura and Kate Malevi have an annual Halloween party, and I want in, Chelsea. So, according to Vogue, the capsule features four of their current signature silhouettes. We have a black and silver sequin halter dress, a black and white slip dress with a rose embellishment, a black and white, and then blood red version of their classic 1930s inspired silk dress with cap sleeves. And then there's the Rodarte shirt with a Beetlejuice cartoon of Lydia and Beetlejuice on it.
So this isn't so much a traditional collab as them just recoloring things they've already made, which, to be fair, are their best-selling designs. And that's what Saks wants, right? We've talked about Saks before. The buyers are risk adverse.
So, Chelsea, I went to Saks.com to look at this collection. And I was stunned to find that, one, when you search Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice into the search bar, this collection does not immediately come up. What instead comes up are curated pieces from other designers, from like Prada to Carolina Herrera, of what I'll call their most Beetlejuicy pieces. I learned that Saks is also doing another exclusive Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice collab. Can you guess what the other brand is? I bet you can't.
No.
It's Fabergé.
Oh, that's random. Look, Rodarte sisters, get your coin from Saks or Beetlejuice or whoever the fuck facilitated this.
Yeah, something tells me that the branding agency for Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Saks and Fabergé are all the same person.
I would have liked to see something new. And also, Lydia Deetz's red wedding gown is the most Rodarte looking garment in the history of cinema. I would love to see them do a riff on that, but I get that this collection was more just about selling things.
Right, instead of them on the runway recreating Beetlejuice pieces.
They could have done more artistic things if that's what was called for in this situation. Like, I loved those Star Wars gowns that they made ages ago with images from those films. So they definitely could have done something similar with Beetlejuice, but Saks obviously doesn't want a $25,000 gown.
And why not, Saks? All you need to do is sell the one.
Just let us dream a little bit.
Can I speak to another grievance I have with this collection, specifically on Saks.com? Because the one piece that I would want to buy that is in my budget is the Rodarte Beetlejuice shirt that has the caricatures from the Beetlejuice cartoon, which I watched as a kid. So when I went to Saks.com, first of all, that shirt and there's a sweatshirt, I was like, I'm interested, but there are no cartoons featured on the product photography. In the Vogue piece of that shirt, the cartoons are featured. On Saks.com, they're not featured. So what's going on here?
Where did they go?
When I first saw the shirt, I was like, ooh, maybe they're on the back. Nope.
Was this some last minute, like, wait, we don't actually have the rights situation?
And also, my other question is, are they going to have this collection in the Beverly Hills store?
I'm not going back there. Never again. Moving on. Supreme has a new owner.
This was a revelation to me because, one, I was unaware that a company called VF Corp owned Supreme, and they're the same company that owned the North Face, Dickies, and Timberland.
Okay, makes sense.
I guess so. And then they sold it to EssilorLuxottica, which I know to be that sunglass conglomerate that makes all the sunglasses for every fashion company.
Yeah, like somehow this company has pretty much a complete monopoly on sunglasses because they own all the sunglasses huts. They own Oakley. They make all the glasses for all of the high-end brands.
Chanel, Armani, Prada.
So if you have a pair of sunglasses, regardless of where they were purchased, there's a good chance that they were manufactured by these people.
It seems clear that Supreme's previous owners, VF Corp, overpaid for the brand because in 2020, they bought Supreme for $2.1 billion. And they sold it just 4 years later for $1.5 billion, which I'm not great at math, Chell, but that seems to be quite a bit less.
Well, it was clearly overvalued, although I think the narrative that Supreme is flopping is a little insane.
You're more of a Supreme hype beast than me. Do tell.
I'm not a Supreme hype beast. I'm just saying, like, this is a once in a lifetime kind of brand that will go through ups and downs, and perhaps it was overvalued.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough when you put, especially a drop-centric company, when they are valued and bought at these kinds of price points, because I think the expectation, like a lot of luxury fashion brands operating at this level, that it's just going to be infinite growth, which is just not possible.
For them, it could be possible, but they're about opening physical stores. If they opened more stores, I'm sure their profits would increase. I think they're very thoughtful about everything they do.
Right. I do love the corporate speak around the buying and selling of Supreme because the VF Corp president said that the reason for the sale was that there were limited synergies between Supreme and VF Corp that made a sale a, quote, natural next step. And then its buyer, EssilorLuxottica, said that we see an incredible opportunity in bringing an iconic brand like Supreme into our company. It perfectly aligns with our innovation and development journey, offering us a direct connection to new audiences, language, and creativity. Which kind of all feels like code to me for, we can't wait to sell $300 Supreme sunglasses at an airport sunglass hub.
Yeah, but they can't actually do that because then people won't care about Supreme. It's like, if it's based on scarcity, they have to maintain that. Despite the sort of obvious ways that they could make a quick buck. It's just such a specific business model, and hopefully they won't fuck it up. We'll see.
Well, I, for one, look forward to the Supreme X Sunglass Hut collab.
Ew. Is it trap time?
It is time to talk about the film Trap. In our outline and previous in this episode, I did not correct you. You've referred to it as The Trap. The film is called Trap.
I refuse to accept that.
I've been calling the film Trapped. So there's something about this title that just does not stick in either of our memories. And when I told my mother that I saw the film Trapped, she goes, I think you mean the M. Night Shyamalan film, not the film Trapped, because that was a 2002 film with Charlize Theron, Courtney Love, Stuart Townsend, and Kevin Bacon. I was like, look at you being a little IMDb mom.
Yeah, I think I missed that one.
Okay, so we are talking about the 2024 M. Night Shyamalan film Trap, starring Josh Hartnett. M. Night Shyamalan pitched this film as Silence of the Lambs at a Taylor Swift concert. Chelsea, do you think it delivered on that promise?
I think Lady Raven has more in common with Ariana Grande, personally.
Lady Raven is not Taylor Swift.
Like, the only Taylor Swiftian thing that she does is sit down at the piano for that one song.
Very true. So we should say that we're going to talk about this film in a non-spoiler fashion, and then we will get into spoilers. We'll make that distinction very clearly for all of those that are spoiler adverse. You can hop off of the episode when we let you know.
I loved it, personally. Trap is not high art, but it does the job. And I think that's true of most M. Night Shyamalan films. I am a fan. whether it's The Sixth Sense or Old. He always takes me on an unexpected journey.
I did enjoy this film. For me, it ranks as my fourth favorite M. Night film, although I have not seen Old. I would love to know where this film sits on your ranking. Because your Signs, Sixth Sense,
Unbreakable, then The Village, then maybe Split. I don't know. There's also ones I haven't seen. You know, like there was one with Dakota Fanning that came out last year, I think, that I never saw.
Oh, right.
And I never saw Lady in the Water also, so I can't speak to that. I don't like The Happening. However, lawnmower scene, so iconic, it kind of makes the whole thing worth watching.
And also Mark Wahlberg's delivery of when the old woman says, "What are you here to kill me?" And he goes, "What? No."
That also. It doesn't rank high.
Okay.
But I did enjoy watching it.
Because for me, I think it's Sixth Sense, Signs, Split, because I really like Split. And I'll put Trap after this. I like a grounded, a semi-grounded M. Night Shyamalan film. And to your point, I don't think anyone has seen Lady in the Water.
Although it's probably good. I'm a huge Village apologist, throwing it back to our boy Joaquin. So maybe Lady in the Water is fab and we just like don't know.
Yeah, I would say the biggest hindrance of this film, and it's a known thing about M. Night Shyamalan films, is the dialogue, where like the halting, awkward dialogue works perfectly for something like The Village or The Sixth Sense. For something that is so contemporary like this film, it does take you out of it just a little bit.
Yeah, the tone of the movie is very bizarre from the get-go. And it's not just because there's a serial killer at the Lady Raven concert. It's also just campier than I thought. Like that part where he pushes the random woman down the stairs, incredibly funny, comes out of left field. Also, I think we should note the fact that while this film is not a comedy, the audience that we saw it with very much thought that it was one.
I think what aided in my enjoyment of this film is we were with a very good audience that was laughing throughout the film. I would say in the correct parts. You don't actually see him as a serial killer murder anyone. I feel like the worst thing he does in this film is intentionally scar a poor food service worker at the venue by throwing peanut oil into the fryer to create a distraction. So to your point about like pushing the woman down the stairs, throughout the film, when he is at the concert, he's trying to create several distractions so he can escape or at least assess the situation.
Yeah, yet somehow it's still kind of campy and not that scary. Like what distinguishes it from Silence of the Lambs is the lack of gruesomeness when it comes to the crimes.
Well, because it's all implied or inferred. I thought the most tense-filled thing is there is a B-plot throughout the concert that his daughter is on the outs with her friends because of something that happened before the film at school. And so the mom of the other girl is frequently like stopping and impeding Josh Hartnett from doing the things he needs to do.
Okay, but also, this is the weirdest vibe. It's a concert in the middle of the day. Somehow, no one's ever watching Lady Raven perform. This whole movie is just like him and his daughter walking around, getting merch and stuff.
To be fair, at a certain point, his daughter is like, "Why are you acting so weird?" I don't think this is a spoiler because it is in the trailer, right? Somehow the FBI knows that the Philadelphia Butcher is going to be at this Lady Raven concert. The FBI has gone to the Taylor Swift of this universe and been like, "Hey, can we run a sting operation during your concert and try to find a serial killer?" And she's like, "Yeah, absolutely." Like, I saw a tweet that was like, could you imagine the class action lawsuit when those 80,000 people realize they were trapped in a venue with a serial killer?
Yeah, it's super fucked up. Also, can we talk about the fact that Haley Mills is like the head of the FBI, essentially? Is that what she is?
She's the FBI profiler.
Yeah.
So I saw her name come up in the opening credits, and I did have a terrible thought, which was like, I thought it can't be the same Haley Mills. That Haley Mills from The Parent Trap must be dead.
I don't think that's a crazy thought just because we haven't seen her in a film in years.
And we were whispering to each other throughout the film where I was like, is that the Haley Mills? Because they don't show you her face until the end of the film. So you're like, is this just an old lady?
And then you're like, that's Haley Mills. I could recognize that face anywhere. But did he cast her simply because her most famous film is called The Parent Trap and this film is called Trap? Like, that seems like a weird coincidence.
I would give him a lot of credit if that's why he cast her. I think that is brilliant.
I don't know why else he would. She was fully retired.
My last non-spoiler opinion about this film is there is something about modern films where they cannot just end. And I feel like every film now has five endings.
Well, this one really has five endings.
So shall we get into spoiler territory?
Sure. Guys, just turn off the episode if you don't want the twist revealed. Although the twist is not giving Sixth Sense. It's not giving Signs. It's not that.
I would almost say the twist is there is no twist.
I guess the twist is that it continues on for longer than anyone would reasonably expect.
There's a certain point in the film where the concert is ending and I was like, oh, if he is able to get out of the venue without being caught, I was like, what a wonderful subversion to this kind of film, right? Like, I would have been satisfied if the concert ends, he's able to get out, no one catches him, and he's able to keep going. But that's not where the film ends. Wow, we didn't even talk about Josh Hartnett, who is unbelievably charming in the film.
Because the relationship with his daughter does feel quite genuine. He does love her.
Right. I saw another tweet that was talking about this film where they were like, this is just a film about a dad grappling with his life-work balance.
Yeah, essentially. But I, too, was shocked when this film just wouldn't end.
In his perverse, evil, but also like good for his daughter way, he has lied to M. Night Shyamalan himself in his cameo, who is the uncle of Lady Raven, to get his daughter on stage so that he is not stopped by the cops. If his daughter is selected, he's able to get backstage and there's no security stopping anyone when they get backstage. That's when I was like, if he's able to just get out of here and like credits, I would have been satisfied with that. But he then blackmails Lady Raven, which if you didn't already know that M. Night Shyamalan's daughter is Lady Raven, you really know when the back third of this film becomes about her. I also thought she was great in the film. The songs are good. I believe she wrote them. Like, good for her.
Yeah, the songs do the job. I don't know if we needed so much of it, but it did feel believable.
And knowing that that is M. Night Shyamalan's daughter, I think explains why Lady Raven is featured so prominently throughout the film and the whole, well, at least four of the five endings involve her.
Yeah, my favorite part was when she basically rescued that guy via Instagram Live.
That's when the world sort of breaks down, right? Because she is forced to take them via her limo, which is a huge buy-in that a Taylor Swift-level pop star leaves without any security, or at the very least, leaves without several SUVs following her when she leaves a concert.
And then basically for the next hour, Josh Hartnett narrowly escapes getting captured like 50 times.
I think it's only 20 minutes, but I swear to you, it feels like an hour because this movie...
I think it was an hour.
The movie's only an hour and 40 minutes.
Oh, okay. Maybe not.
All films feel 3 hours because if you see it at an AMC, you are inundated with 35 minutes of trailers. So you're already 30 minutes into watching a film.
The ending definitely leaves the door open for a trap two.
That's when they call it Trapped.
Lady Raven's Revenge.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, we didn't even say Alison Pill is in this film.
Oh yeah. Nice to see her.
Playing Josh Hartnett's wife.
Yeah, his long-suffering wife.
Which I guess if there is a twist to this film, you are led to believe that the reason the FBI is at the Lady Raven concert is because the butcher, played by Josh Hartnett, fucked up and dropped a receipt. Somehow he has a printed receipt of buying these Lady Raven concert tickets.
That don't have any information about his seats? I don't... The whole thing is fucking crazy.
If there is a twist, I suppose it's that Allison Pill, she at the very least discovered her husband has a secret house and wasn't sure if he was cheating on her or if he was a serial killer. So she gave this anonymous information to the FBI just to see what was true.
Yeah, that reveal didn't hit particularly hard.
Because we felt like we were hour three into the film by the time it happened.
Well, I guess it did answer our question about how the fuck did they know that the butcher was going to be at the Lady Raven concert? Because that does not make sense throughout the whole movie. And barely makes sense when they give you the explanation, but still.
Yeah, because it's presupposing that it's the 1990s and that Josh Hartnett's character has gone to the Ticketmaster window to buy these Lady Raven tickets. It's like, you buy it online, they send you an email, you then download an app, and it's on your phone. Which it is, because you see he gets in through his phone.
I don't think you need to see this movie in a theater, although if you have a fun crowd, it's fun to see it in a theater. But this is a perfect VOD situation.
Knowing the way that theatrical windows are now, you could probably see it in a week and a half on streaming.
True. Also, you should see Old. Watch that and get back to me.
All right. I have so many recommendations from you. I'm halfway through Presumed Innocent.
Okay, are you hating it or loving it? I thought you would like it because you like movies about guys that kill their wives.
This is true. Paul and I were going through a phase where we watched Did I Kill My Wife films.
And this is not quite that, but close to that. It's Did I Kill My Mistress?
We watched Jagged Edge, which is a film written by Joe Esterhaus, who wrote Basic Instinct as basically a gender swap of his film Jagged Edge. And the film that is recommended right after that is Presumed Innocent, and we just never watched it. Which, that was the other crazy thing, is when Presumed Innocent came out, I was like, that is so crazy to call a TV show the same thing as that Harrison Ford film from the 80s. And then it's like, no, this is a remake of that movie.
I haven't seen that movie in so long, though. I want to rewatch it. I do remember thinking that the VHS case was quite compelling.
So to answer your question, I hate every moment of this series, but I cannot stop watching.
So you love it.
I watched 4 episodes in a row. Here's the thing. I do not like Jake Gyllenhaal's character. You're not meant to like him.
Yeah, it's like a Ben Affleck and Gone Girl type vibe.
I do enjoy how they explain how he is somehow a 42-year-old Jake Gyllenhaal that has a 17-year-old son. I love how they go out of their way to be like, you know, when we first got together when we were 20 and then we immediately got pregnant. I'm like, okay, they're not going to pretend like he's 50 but has a 17-year-old but magically looks like an early 40s Jake Gyllenhaal. I did appreciate that.
I think you're thinking too deeply about Presumed Innocent.
I can't help it, because if I don't think about these details, then I'm thinking about the bonkers accent that this DA has.
I have finished the series. I'm curious to know what you think.
I'm going to be burning through it this weekend, so I'll have my answer. Question for you. Do they ever answer why Peter Skarsgård wears a bolo in court?
No.
Oh, damn it.
They don't.
All right, guys. Until next week.
Bye.
Bye.